But water.
All right, everyone, today is May 7th, 2015. This is a subcommittee on public safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 5015. Mr. Rocco.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 5015 is the budget bill for the district attorneys and their deputies. We posted materials on OLIS for this work session. The recommended budget from the Legislative Fiscal Office is $11,644,429 general fund and 36 positions, 36.00 FTE. This is about a 7.3% increase over the 13-15 legislatively approved number. And as you can see in the work session presentation report, there are no changes from the current service level budget for this agency.
All right.
Is that it?
That's the first part.
Okay.
So if you want to move that recommendation, then
you have to make a motion.
No, I'm going to need the piece of paper, Mr. Mr. Rocco, because I don't have it pulled up right now. I move the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5015.
Senator Shields moves the LFO recommendations 5015. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Under performance measures, we have some recommended changes with performance measures, two target changes and one deletion. And if you look at the key performance measure report, there's a summary of these recommendations. We're basically asking to have the target changed for KPM number 4 from 100% to 92%. And the reason for this is that only 33 counties of the 36 actually have these programs, so it would be impossible to reach 100%. We're recommending a change in KPM number 2 to a target of 95 from 90, since the agency has reported achieving 95 regularly in the last several years. And then finally, we're recommending a deletion of KPM number 3, which is the customer service survey, since technically the DAs would have to do 36 of these, each one in each of the counties, and we think that's, they've never really done this performance measure before anyway, so we just thought it was proper to just delete it since this is a required KPM for all agencies, but as we've talked about previously, the DA's is a sort of a special agency, and we don't think that this KPM really works for them. And we have discussed this with the DA's, and they're in agreement with these changes.
Okay, and ready for a motion on key performance measures?
Yes.
Madam Co-Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures.
Senator Shields moves the LFO recommendation on key performance measures. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
So, Madam Chair, so yes. For the DA's budget, we didn't approve any of the POPs? Not the 5,000 for the additional?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, no, there are no approved packages in this budget. It's a straight current service level budget.
And what was the, Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. Mr. Rocco, what were the 7.3% increase?
That is correct, yes.
And FTEs?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, no change in FTEs. There are 36 county DAs, and okay. And there remain 36.
Thank you. Okay.
All right.
So, Madam Chair, the LFO recommended budget is, as I said before, is $11,644,429 general fund.
And so are you ready for a motion on the amendment?
Yes.
Okay, so the Dash 1 amendment includes those changes. So I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 5015.
Senator Shields moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 5015. Is there any discussion?
I'm sorry, I was a few minutes late. So we do not have we're not going to help
we're not going to pick up the $5,000. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. I'm a no then.
Okay, on the dash one.
Yes.
We'll find out.
We'll find out. All right. Objection, yes.
Objection noted. And
all right.
You're outvoted.
There you go.
You should have supported him and we'd have been in trouble.
Ready for motion on that?
Yeah, three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 5015 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves House Bill 5015 as amended to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I may vote no on the floor.
All right. Thank you for not voting no now.
I'm a no.
All right. So you got that.
You just stand, okay. Stand at ease, mm-hmm. don't you? Oh,
no.
Nope. Okay.
No, we're good.
All right.
So moved. Anything else on this, Mr. Rocco?
No, just carriers, Madam Chair.
I'll carry in full.
Yeah. Carry in hospital if you want to. Unless you would like to carry in.
No, it'd be no.
Oh, no, that way I can keep you a yes. All right, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 5015 and open up public hearing on House Bill or on Senate Bill 5533, Public Defense Services Commission. Nancy Cosine, come on down. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair and subcommittee members. Public Defense Services Commission is back today for phase two of their budget hearing. Their phase one budget hearing was back in March, and they're coming back. They've been asked to come back to talk a bit more about portions of their request and some related information. Primarily, they have requests for funding to address compensation provided to public defenders and other persons providing public defense services. And they're going to be providing additional information on that as well as on some of their pumps.
Excellent. Ms. Cosine.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williams, Co-Chair Shields, members of the subcommittee, Mr. Bender. For the record, my name is Nancy Cosine, Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services, and it is an honor to be in front of you to talk a little bit more about the Public Defense Services budget. Today, I will cover a little bit of background about our policy option packages, give you some information about our current contract rates, and then delve into the details of our priority policy option packages. I hope to get you out of here earlier. So absent questions, I think this should take 50 to 60 minutes. And that's not to discourage you from asking questions, of course. So feel free to interrupt if you have questions. And I'll get right to it. The information about our current priority policy option packages really begins with the end of the 2013 session. I've mentioned this before, but there was a floor debate on the House side. There were protest votes. And the recurring question that I was hearing was, how much would it take to get public defenders to parity? So in 2013, clearly we did not have enough for that. We did have two opportunities for incremental improvement. One was a funding for compensation to improve hourly rates. So we gave a $1 increase to our hourly rate providers. And then our nonprofit public defenders also received compensation funding for their compensation increases in the amount of $2.3 million. That amount, the PDSC distributed according to the level of disparity in each county. And as you will see on the next slide, the level of disparity in some counties remains at the 50% level, in some counties at the top end of the pay scale. So these are deputy district attorneys and public defenders at our nonprofit public defender offices. These are the counties, the ones that you see, that have a nonprofit public defender office. The only one not included is Umatilla County, and that's because that eight-lawyer office actually reached parity. They have lower pay scales out there, and they had significant recruitment problems. Several contract cycles ago, the agency made that adjustment. It gave them additional funding to make that adjustment, I should say. But the rest of our counties still really struggle. I wanted to mention that this is the 2014 pay scales. The public defender offices remain the same, but many of the district attorney offices either have or will receive increases. So, for example, Marion County, the top is now up to 137. So in that county in 2015, we're actually closer to 50% again. So we continue to fall behind year after year. This is the bottom of the pay scale, and I wanted to point this out because you'll see that there are counties where we're closer at the bottom of the pay scale and further at the top, and that's really because each entity struggles more or less with retention or recruitment, so they adjust their scales to address the larger of their problems. Deschutes in particular, you know, at the top end, they've made it to 3%, but at the bottom, they're still at 26. The other thing I wanted to point out is that if we looked at benefits, the disparity would be more significant. I'll use Jackson County as the example. In that county, the nonprofit public defender office does afford health benefits for its employees, but not the employee's family. So in Jackson County, if a public defender wants to insure a spouse, that public defender has to pay $580 per month to get the coverage for the spouse. If they want to get coverage for a child, it's $486 per month. If they have more than one child, they can purchase a family plan at $1,070 per month. So if you go back and you take that into account in Jackson County, if they want health benefits, and we're not talking about the difference in retirement at all, just health, they've reduced their income by $12,000, which makes them significantly below what they're making in the DA's office. And of course, that's just comparing to salary again. So we really are struggling to keep our public defender offices at a place where they are competitive at all with the prosecution. And I want to note that by no means do I intend to imply that the prosecution is overpaid. If you look at the 2012 economic survey from the Oregon State Bar, prosecutors are also underpaid compared to the rest of the market. And so I want to just make clear that I'm not trying to criticize anyone else. I'm just pointing out that we are falling further and further behind every time we don't make some incremental improvement. Those are our public defenders who are in nonprofit public defender offices. We have these other three groups, really, the hourly, which I mentioned, that got the one-hour bump. And then we have consortia and law firms. That group, the consortium and law firm group, did not receive any substantial bump in 2014 contract cycle that started after the 13th session. So their true way to increase income is increasing caseload size. And that creates a problem for our clients. This is what we've been able to do for consortiums over the last 5 years. So in 2010 through 13, we were flat because of the economy. Last year, we were able to give them a 3 to 3.25% increase on average, but it was not enough to keep up with the rising costs of running a business. I want to mention this chart shows the average case rate. It does not include our two most expensive case rates, which are murder and Measure 11, because that tends to throw it off, in terms of giving you an idea of what it looks like. Those are higher case rates. A Measure 11 is 1,800, and a murder is about 18,000, a little over. Nonetheless, this is an average of all other crime types. So we set the rate according to the crime seriousness level, which means that a misdemeanor is going to be a lower rate than a felony.
Madam Co-Chair. Nancy, I brought this up, I think, in your phase one presentation. I was concerned about the incentives when counsel gets paid a flat rate, whether or not the client pleads or whether or not it goes to trial. Could that be changed by the commission, or would that take legislation to do something to give somebody a little bit of a bump if they actually went to trial?
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, the commission has the authority to structure payments in any manner that meets our statutory obligations. There used to be hourly rates that were provided, and it made costs very difficult to predict. And so over the course of many years, the commission has actually switched to a flat rate model. And what that does is it encourages providers to take a larger volume of cases, because then your average, your trials and your pleas tend to average things out. And I'm actually going to go into that in some detail here. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. No, and I just wanted to know, if we decided to make that policy choice, could you do it by yourself, or will we have to ram it down your throat?
We could. The commission could make that choice, but it would probably increase costs and make our costs less predictable.
Of course.
So I wanted to be very clear that our rates are flat rates. They're not hourly rates, except for that 2% of hourly providers. Our contract providers are on this flat rate system where they have to pay all of their expenses out of that flat rate. So I have listed here some of the types of costs that providers have to pay, and I want to make clear this is just a sampling. I pulled this to some degree from what was presented during phase one by Rosalind Lee. She's a provider from Eugene. But I also included in your appendix something that is produced by the Oregon State Bar's Professional Liability Fund, and it's titled A Guide to Setting Up and Running Your Law Office, Avoiding Malpractice Through Efficient Office Systems. And not only does it include a very nice list of all the things that a lawyer needs to acquire in order to efficiently run a law office, it also really gives a nice summary of the complexities of running a law office. A lawyer has to be very conscientious about the way that everything is managed in a firm, and, you know, money, conflicts checks, everything. It's a complex business. So if you have an interest in looking into those details, I think it is a helpful guide. And I'm really grateful, actually, to the PLF for allowing us to submit that to you. This list does not include retirement, and I didn't include it because it wasn't actually on Rosalind's submission in phase one, but you can, I've resubmitted that and you can look back at it. The other thing I wanted to point out is that her, what she submitted included only 0.5 FTE for support staff, which means that the lawyer then is responsible for all those pieces of operating the law office that 0.5 staff can't get to, including returning client phone calls. So, I wanted to give you a sense of what the rates are and what the difference is now between our nonprofit public defender offices and our consortium and law firm groups. So this slide is intended to do that. We do have different case rates in different regions to reflect the cost of living differences and the differences in attracting lawyers to these regions. So this is a metropolitan area average. So if you are in the metro area, this is about what you get for each misdemeanor case. Now for policy option package 100. This is the package that would bring consortium and law firm groups up to the rate that you just saw for nonprofit public defender offices. It would not do more than that. It would not address that disparity that we saw on charts 4 and 5. It would only get the consortiums to where the PDs are now. Because policy option package 100 is really concentrated on these law firms and consortium groups, I wanted to give you a concrete example of what the economics of their situation is. And so I'm gonna give you the caveat that I'm gonna delve into some details here, and it's after the lunch hour and it's a lot of numbers. If you have questions, feel free to ask, and I'm also happy to meet with you at any time to look at this further. But I wanted to give you one example so that you would get a sense of what it's like to try and run a business on these rates. As a reminder, consortiums make up about 64%, and law firms, about 64% of our provider community. Only 2% are the non-contract hourly, with 34% as public defenders. And we have consortiums and law firms in every county, one of the two, in every single county across the state. Again, there's the difference, and what we're working to increase is the firm rate for consortium. And so, heading now into the exercise of giving you an example of what it's like to run a business at this case rate, I decided to use Rosalind's example, which her example included the 0.5 FTE, no retirement, and overhead costs, and she totaled that to be $43,600 per year. This is a Eugene example, so it's probably higher in the metro area, but I felt it was better to use something provided by a consortium member who had taken input from other people. So at a case rate of $340 per case, you can do the math and figure out that in order to just cover the overhead and staff expenses, she has to take 129 cases. If she's going to dedicate a portion, which is more likely, a portion of her contract rate to cover overhead expenses, that's the way most businesses operate. If she dedicates 45%, that's $153 per year to cover overhead expenses. If she were to have a full-time staff, and I just want to point this out, if she were to have full-time staff at $15 per hour, that would be $31,200 per year, and that's not including taxes or benefits for staff. And so, again, I just want to emphasize the fact that that $43,000 is probably an underestimate for most of our lawyers. A misdemeanor trial and length of time required or hours required to complete the case. Again, I wanted to err on the side of an underestimate. This is really the bare bones of what's required to complete a case. Things that are not included in this time estimate would be things like a pretrial release motion and hearing, which is particularly common in cases like an assault four, motions for discovery, suppression, a motion in limine, special jury instructions, appeal referral or follow-up, plea negotiations, investigation of immigration consequences. So I suspect that on the whole, this is an underestimate. I've looked at the time studies that were recently done in both Texas and Missouri, and according to their numbers, this would be considered an underestimate. And I'm estimating that a plea would take about 5 hours. Again, if you look at this list and you add up the time required to get to a plea, you know, filling out the plea, you know, doing all of the arraignment, discovery review, initial client meeting, investigation, some amount of legal research, and at least one pretrial conference, plea negotiations, reviewing plea discussions, sentencing, closing letter, you can't really avoid at least 5 hours of work on a case that's a misdemeanor. The average, if you look at the estimate of 24 hours for a trial and 5 hours for a plea, if you took 100 cases, that's about 5.95 hours per case. And I'll go into more of these details. Again, I apologize for going to these numbers after the lunch hour, but
this is great.
It's instructive.
Thank you.
So here we go. All expenses have to be paid before the attorney can start to earn any money. If the attorney could use that entire $340 case rate for the trial, They would be earning $14.17 per hour. But if they dedicate 45% to the overhead costs, they're now earning $7.79 per hour.
So it's
of course, it's not good. I mean, I admit that. We know that not all cases go to trial, and this Cotrio Shields gets at your question about, you know, what are the incentives and what if something goes to trial and it takes an extraordinarily long time? And we heard from Rosalind Lee when she testified at phase one that she's leaving this business because it doesn't pencil out for her. I looked at the trial rates in 2011 from our three metro counties, and I will say that getting data after that is a little complicated because of the switch over to eCourt, so I think this is their last published data. So that's what I used. The average, the misdemeanor trial rate then for the three counties is 5.313%. I applied that then to our hypothetical example. And so using that metropolitan area misdemeanor trial rate, if the lawyer takes five misdemeanor trials and 95 pleas, they're going to earn $18,699.80 pre-tax for every 100 cases that they take. I will mention that the majority of our easier misdemeanor cases, Bs, Cs, and things that aren't complex, they tend to run through an ECR, an early resolution docket. We pay those at a different rate, a lower rate. We staff the courtroom, so those are kind of out of the mix, and what we're talking about really is the more complex misdemeanor type cases. And so the trial rate might be higher. That's my point. So if a lawyer takes 285 cases per year in order to make that to cover their their overhead and staff costs. The annual gross income for 285 cases then is just over $53,000, and that requires almost 1,700 hours of just the work if you include those underestimate hours that I gave you. If you include things like the administrative duties that they would have with only 0.5 staff, their continuing legal education requirements, professional meetings, returning client phone calls, returning and initiating calls with the court, and attending other professional obligations, you can see that their time now is stretched very thin and their opportunity to meet with clients is very, very limited. At 285 cases per year, the lawyer is taking approximately 5.3 cases per week. That's more than 5 new clients every week, so a little more than one per day, who is at risk of imprisonment for up to a year. So, the other reminder about that is that at 0.5 staff and at that high a caseload, you really realistically probably need more staff time just to return the client phone calls and make sure all your clients are getting to the right place at the right time. But when I ran these numbers, I wanted to compare that to what we see in the metro area region for subsidized housing for low-income people. And if a lawyer is making that much money and has two kids and a spouse, they're going to qualify for some low-income housing assistance. And that's a reality. And I then compared...
Is that a policy option package?
I wanted to take you back to slide 5. Yes, gallows
never gets
humor.
Old.
Gallows humor. Slide 5 shows you in the metro region that for our Multnomah County lawyers, they're just over 55. And so when you're looking at the difference in case rate, it plays out just about right. If you think about the fact that we've probably underestimated the hours and what we're coming out with for those consortium and law firm is a bit lower, both of these groups, if they have a family, are going to be qualifying for some kind of subsidized housing. We've heard from lawyers that they're trying to pay back student loan debt, they're trying to purchase houses, and it's making a strain on their professional lives that is extraordinary. Our law firm and consortium providers are not eligible for loan repayment programs because they're not employed by a government or nonprofit entity. I also wanted to point out the comparison when you look at the 2012 bar survey for this area. The reality is we're closer to comparing our lawyers in this hypothetical example to low-income housing than we are to the 75th percentile, the 25th percentile earners in the practice of law. And I think you can see how then what we're encouraging with our current rate is higher caseloads, and that compromises the lawyer's ability to meet their professional obligations. When we each year submit out to judges and other participants in the system our survey, we ask for their impressions about caseload and lawyer performance, and we really do hear that our lawyers are doing good or excellent work. But we also hear very clearly that the caseloads are too high. So 40% of responding judges indicate that juvenile dependency lawyers have excessive caseloads, and 55% of responding judges said that criminal caseloads were too high. The American Bar Association has workload guidelines, and in those, they offer some sort of a barometer of whether or not a client is dedicating sufficient time to their cases, and they recommend that a supervisor look at whether or not sufficient time is devoted to interviewing and counseling clients, whether prompt interviews are conducted of detained clients and those who are released from custody, whether pretrial release is sought, and whether representation is continuously provided by the same lawyer from the start to the end of the case, whether necessary investigations are conducted, whether formal and informal discovery of the prosecution is pursued, whether sufficient legal research is undertaken, whether sufficient preparations for pretrial hearings and trials are made, and whether sufficient preparations are made for hearings at which clients are sentenced. Clearly, if a lawyer doesn't come prepared with enough information about the client as well as the facts of the case, the court simply doesn't have the information it needs to impose the appropriate sentence. The commission is aware of these guidelines, and we are working to try and better measure from where we sit whether or not these types of actions are being taken by the lawyers who perform public defense work. When these are not met, everyone loses, the client and the community in which that client lives. When a lawyer has an excessive caseload, they're also risking their professional, their bar license. Formal ethics opinion indicates that when a lawyer has an excessive caseload, they do risk violating at least 4 rules of professional conduct. And if they are found in violation, they can be suspended or disbarred. I think our lawyers work very hard to make sure that these types of consequences aren't imposed, but it is a risk.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. So how many people have been disbarred in the last year or two?
Representative Barker, Co-Chair Williams, Co-Chair Shields, members of the subcommittee, I do not have the answer to that question, and I can look to see whether or not any of our providers have been disbarred. We work closely with the bar on any complaint that's filed against one of our providers, and we try to manage situations. In other words, if we have indicators in advance, we try and address those quickly, but I can look into that.
Well, I don't need a hard number, but I mean, is that happening a lot? Are people getting in trouble a lot, or no?
Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, Representative Barker, I certainly hope not. I really would have to look. We get a weekly report, and we follow up on them weekly. I would really have to look into that. Mm-hmm. I certainly know that in this practice, and you've probably heard this, criminal practice in domestic relations draws the highest number of complaints.
Yeah. Sure.
So, two states, Missouri and Texas, recently did workload studies. And the recommendations in those states for misdemeanor cases was 178 in Missouri and 216 Class A misdemeanors. Out of Texas, 2 additional states, Rhode Island and Tennessee, are underway with caseload studies. This is something we'd actually like to have a caseload study that is applicable to Oregon. They cost about $100,000. But, you know, when you get all the pieces in place, it's something we are examining. But you can look at these numbers and compare them to the numbers we've been talking about, and it gives you a sense of the reasonableness of caseload size in our hypothetical.
Mm-hmm. Shields.
Co-Chair, we have a term for that in Ways and Means. It's called documenting the obvious when we go out and get a study to tell us what we already know.
Yes, yes. So the other little piece of Policy Option Package 100 is mileage reimbursement. And providers in the Eastern region are dedicating a larger percentage of their contract rate just to travel expenses. We don't pay them any additional time or money for the time that they spend driving, but they do cover quite a bit of territory. You can see that this is documenting the obvious. There's some big counties out there. So people have to drive a lot to get to their home visits with clients who are in foster care, or to get to clients who are in a custody facility that is far away from where they're located.
Gotcha. And you might have hit this earlier, and perhaps I missed it, but if somebody's representing people in Gillam and Wheeler counties, they get reimbursed the same as somebody who is in Marion County, or do you have a differential?
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, we do have different rates in different regions, okay, depending on what the circumstances and cost of living are, and our ability to get people out there too.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. Does that try to take into account how much an attorney might have to travel if somebody has to go from Hood River to Wheeler County in order to represent someone?
Co-Chair Shields, it's intended to. But what we're hearing is that we haven't been doing as good a job with that as we should be, which is why we put in the mileage piece. and I would also point out that I think our lawyers try and do as much as they can over telephone and video conference, but there are meetings for which it really you have to be there in person to review evidence, to have a conversation. So, and it's required in many instances by the rules of professional conduct and the performance standards. So policy option package 100, we feel, is really about risk avoidance. It avoids the risk of providers taking higher caseloads in the next contracting cycle. Our RFP is out right now. Proposals are due at the end of June, and we'll be evaluating those proposals starting as soon as they're all in. It also reduces the risk of losing additional providers. We know that we are losing people. It reduces the risk of post-conviction relief and malpractice claims. It reduces the risk of someone spending more time in prison or time in prison when they ought to be on probation because the lawyer didn't have the time to investigate the circumstances and present them to the court effectively. It reduces the risk of unnecessary removal of children from their homes or unnecessary termination of parental rights when lawyers have the time to work with their clients to help present the information to the court that the court needs to make the appropriate findings. It reduces the chance of procedural injustice created by lawyers having too many cases. And it reduces the risk of legal action. And I wanted to bring this up. We feel strongly that in Oregon, because there's statewide oversight, because there's a commission, we have done a very good job of meeting the commission's obligation of providing public defense services in the most cost-efficient manner consistent with the state and federal constitution. There are municipalities in this country where there have been lawsuits filed. I've included those in your appendix. One is actually right in Washington State, and so it's a close by area. The other is in New York, and so those cases are there. In both of those cases, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a statement of interest in which they recommended stronger oversight and contracting limitations for those municipalities.
Nancy, is that in our appendix?
It is.
The DOJ stuff?
It is.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I will move on to Package 103. This is our hourly provider increase package, and you could run through the same exercise with this that I did with the flat rate, and you would see that for our hourly rate providers at $46 an hour, taking the same number of misdemeanor cases, they would come out after paying their overhead expenses at just over $50,000 as well. So they're in a similar situation. They also, you know, they have to pay their overhead and staff expenses out of that hourly rate, just the way that flat rate providers do. Policy option package 104 is the last of the priority policy option packages. This is just a piece of policy option package 104, and it is the piece that covers the administrative costs of running our parent-child representation program and having a lawyer on staff who specializes in quality assurance in juvenile cases. So when we received funding to demonstrate improvements in dependency cases at the end of 2013, that was in our professional services account for providers. We didn't have a piece that was actually dedicated to administration within our office. So we created a limited duration position, and this package seeks to make actually two, one for data and one for the lawyer role. This seeks to make those permanent positions, and it really is critical. The Deputy General Counsel has three primary responsibilities. One is managing the parent-child representation program. Another is statewide quality assurance. And the third is being backup to our General Counsel, who represents the agency and the commission. There are instances where a provider may challenge our denial of a non-routine expense request or our denial of or a reduction of hours if we feel like they've been they're requesting more than what they've demonstrated, and our counsel litigates those cases. And he also oversees the quality assurance for our criminal law providers. So originally he was doing all of the quality assurance in all case types, and it was too much for one person to do. So with the division of roles, it's really allowed us to spend more time working with our providers statewide. So in terms of responsibilities as the manager for the parent-child representation program, Deputy General Counsel provides oversight of the lawyers in the program, including review and analysis of attorney time logs, activity reports, and regular review of attorney compliance with the bar performance standards. She coordinates partner meetings at the state and local level to gather feedback regarding attorney performance and to implement additional improvements or communication. And she plans and facilitates multidisciplinary trainings in those pilot counties involving the lawyers in those counties. And she continues to make sure that all of the decisions we're making in the program are working toward the ultimate goals of the program, which are to ensure that parents and children have meaningful representation, that there is competent, effective legal representation throughout the life of the case, a reduced number of children in foster care, reduced time to permanency, and an increase in the number of kids who are safely reunified. In terms of statewide quality assurance, her responsibilities are to develop and disseminate training and support guides for lawyers representing parents and children. She hasn't been with us for a year yet, but she's already consulted in over 120 cases across the state to help lawyers figure out how to better represent their clients. And she has planned two statewide juvenile law training conferences, one of which is multidisciplinary, including CASA's district attorneys, assistant attorneys general, DHS caseworkers, CRB representatives, and lawyers for parents and kids, as well as a conference that's dedicated to lawyers and kids, lawyers for parents and children. And then her statewide quality assurance improvements also involve review of all of the requests for non-routine expenses in juvenile cases, investigation and resolution of complaints regarding juvenile representation, and then the system improvements at the statewide level. Just wanted to remind the committee that our agency is actually a very lean agency. 1.5% of our budget is dedicated to administration, and so I just want to reassure you that if you are gracious enough to grant us this piece of Package 104, we will not be overstaffed in the administrative realm. We'll be we're very proud of our low administration, but we do need more. I also wanted to reassure you that our policy option package building process was a collaborative process. We began in October of 2013, just after session ended at our management conference. We held 8 regional meetings across the state that were completed by March of 2014. The Public Defense Services Commission met and had public testimony in January, March, April, May, and June of 2014. And they approved the 8 policy option packages at a public meeting in September of 2014. These are our policy option packages, and I wanted to remind you once again that the ones that we've talked about in detail today don't actually address the disparity that is demonstrated on slides 4 and 5 in your materials. That the package that addresses those is Policy Option Package 101, and we have fallen further behind since creating the package. So that $21.5 million package is the one that would be required to bring us closer to prosecution. And that's not one of the priorities, just to be clear. Our priorities, as established by the commission in December in 2014, again at a public hearing with opportunity for public testimony, were Policy Option Package 100, which is the consistent case rates for our consortium and law firm providers, and the mileage adjustment. Portion of Policy Option Package 103 that improves hourly rates for some of our providers, and then the part of Policy Option Package 104 that provides the administrative oversight. And I just wanted to conclude with this reminder about the complexity of the system. These slides are a dramatic oversimplification, but they're in your Phase 1 materials, and if you wanted to go see through them, you can see where the performance standards link to each phase of a criminal juvenile proceeding. And then final slides. The Public Defense Services Commission, as I mentioned earlier, is required to establish and maintain a public defense system that ensures the provision of public defense services in the most cost-efficient manner consistent with the Oregon Constitution, the United States Constitution, and Oregon and national standards of justice. Policy Option Package 100, as I've stated, gets all of our provider types to the same level. It doesn't address parity. We feel it's critical for us to maintain a system at this point in time, given the costs of running a business. So we are asking that the legislature allow us to hold our providers accountable and to provide the funding necessary for them to meet their obligations under the performance standards and state and federal constitutions.
Representative Krieger.
Pilot project you got going now. Mm-hmm. Got 2 counties and you wanted to have 5?
Co-chairs, Representative Krieger, we have two counties, and in our policy option package 104, we had a an expansion to another two. There is another separate bill, House Bill 2385. I think I have the numbers in the wrong order, but it would expand it further, and that bill actually includes other entities as well. So I would say that the commission is certainly flexible and willing to expand if the legislature had the will in any county that was a high priority county.
We follow up.
Mm-hmm.
At what point are all the children going to be represented immediately?
Co-chair is Representative Krieger. The commission's goal is to have all parents and all children represented immediately at shelter hearings with discovery reviewed and with a plan in place as they head into the shelter hearing. That is not happening right now, and we are working closely with other entities in the dependency system to try and accomplish that goal.
Mm-hmm. As you remember, Madam Chair, that was a priority clear back in 2009. The Chief Justice Symposium on Dependency. We've known about it. We saw the model in Washington. And I would hope we at least get the pilot project funded to where we can see what we can do and what results we get out of it.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
50 minutes.
Done.
All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on 5533. We don't have any other testimony, right?
That's correct.
That was it. Nancy was the only one on my list. So, anything else for the committee?
Do we know future plans, or is that something we need to talk about to Ms. Gilbert?
I know that you are scheduled for public hearing phase two on Department of Corrections on Monday and Tuesday, though I think that that may only end up taking one day.
Okay, great. All right, with that, we're adjourned. Okay, great. All right, with that, we're adjourned.